Today is Thursday. It's June 23rd, 2022. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Tersh Baker. Tersh is spelled T-E-R-S-H. Last name is spelled B-A-K-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. Good evening, Tersh. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, Tom, and yourself?
I'm very fine. Thank you for asking. Tersh, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Certainly, you may.
Thank you so very much. Tersh, what year were you born?
I was born in May of 1943.
Where were you born?
I was born in the city or town, I guess it was, of Hartford, Connecticut, which was approximately near to the Army Air Corps facility. In that part of the world, my dad was a pilot in World War II in the Army Air Corps.
Okay.
And that was close to where he was stationed.
Okay. Did you have any older brothers and sisters?
No, I'm the eldest in my family.
Okay. How did your parents meet?
My dad is the nephew, I guess you would call it, of Horace Albright.
Okay.
It's my understanding, was head of the National Park Service.
Right.
In that era of time in the 20s and 30s and whatever. I met Uncle Horace once in the 1950s in Washington, D.C., and he seemed like a pretty reasonable guy, although pretty gruff. And as it turned out, he is my daughter Ronnie's godfather.
Your sister, but Ronnie?
My sister, Ronnie.
Sister Ronnie's right. Godfather. Hang on
that's
a second.
Right.
So, what's your father's name?
Albert B. for Brewer Baker, B-A-K-E-R, Jr.
Okay. What's your mom's name?
Ruth, R-U-T-H, Stevens, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S, Baker.
Okay. Your dad was a nephew of Horace Albright. Did that mean he was, his mom's brother or his dad's brother?
I do not know.
Okay.
How that fit together. But I do know that they met when my dad came out to the Grand Canyon to be a forest ranger.
What year was that?
That was sometime in the 1930s.
Okay.
Because he was in college at that time, and I guess this was a summer job, but he met my mother. Obviously they'd been there since almost when Arizona became a state, and I've forgotten my history of Arizona, but I think it was either 2016 or 2018. And I believe they came out from California the year after for my grandfather, Stanley G. Stevens, to work for the Fred Harvey Company, who pretty much ran things, had the concession of the canyon, as an accountant. And so apparently he met up with my mother at that time, and they became friends, or whatever relationships were called in those days.
Mm-hmm.
He built the, he was one of the people who built, he spent his summers building the trails from the South Rim down to the river.
Okay.
And I know he built the, what was the trail from the South Rim? The Bright Angel, or is that out of the North Rim? I've forgotten.
Both. The Bright Angel Trail. I'm thinking of South Kaibab and North Kaibab. So the Bright Angel goes from the South Rim down to the river.
Right. Okay, that's what we always took on muleback.
Right.
And he always used to laugh at the turistas that would get on a mule and hold on for dear life, because he said when we were building that trail, we just went down on horseback.
Yeah, great.
And so apparently it was a lot more exciting.
Let's back up a little bit here.
Sure.
And let's reach back to your grandparents on your mom's and dad's side as much as you remember. Now, you mentioned your grandfather, Stanley.
Right.
Stanley G. Stevens. What was he doing in California? Do you remember? Do you have any?
No, I really don't have any information on that. I don't think he was going to. I think he had already graduated from college.
Okay, so he was a college grad.
Because my mother was born in San Diego, California.
Okay.
And that's where she and my grandparents lived.
Okay.
Until they moved to the canyon.
And what roughly year was that?
Oh, gosh. Well, it had to be prior to their moving, and I think they moved over to the canyon in 1919. So the exact year that they moved out to from they were originally from Philadelphia way back in the day.
Okay.
And they moved out to California at some period of time. And my mother did a written history of her experiences at the canyon. And I know in that written history there will be some dates as to when her mother and dad moved out there.
Okay. And do you remember what your grandfather Stanley took in college? You know what his degree was?
It must have been accounting.
Okay.
Or some business type degree.
Business, yeah. Okay. And then
that's what he did for the Fred Harvey Company.
Did they come out and work for Harvey, or was he working for Harvey before Grand Canyon National Park was formed?
That I do not know, Tom.
Okie doke.
I'm hoping that my mother might have expanded on that. You know, when I showed up there, I was only 6 months old.
Right.
So I didn't get the full history as what happened before, you know, my showing up on the earth, I guess, because I was so self-centered.
did your mom and your dad ever talk about any stories about your mom's grandparents at the South Rim?
I'm sure they did. I did not really hear them.
Okay.
But I can tell you how I happened to be is, as I said, my dad was in the Army Air Corps, and I guess my dad went back to school at Williams College it's somewhere in Massachusetts. And after he got out of college, of course, he had Pearl Harbor, and he went into the service. He originally was in the horse cavalry.
Oh, wow.
And he was a horseman, a cavalry guy. When he found out that they were not going to be leading cavalry charges against machine guns,
right,
he decided that they probably ought to do something else. So he passed the flight physical and got to fly B-25 bombers.
Okay.
And he was en route to California to ship out to either the Aleutian Islands or over to China to fly the hump over there, which is what they called the Tibetan area and everything like that. And he at one of the many train stops, because that's how they transported soldiers in those days.
Right.
Called my mother up and said, "Look, I'm headed to go to war, and if you want to see me, I'll be sure I get there to see you."
Oh, wow.
And the rest was history.
Well, that's fun. But how did they... So they would have met at the rim. He was there as a forester. He would have known horses.
Right.
So it makes sense why he would have wanted to be in the horse cavalry if there was such a thing in the service.
Well, he already was at that time.
Okay.
He was in the, I don't know, I guess what they would call it, kind of like ROTC today.
Okay.
But they did that, I'm assuming in college, I don't know.
Okay.
The only thing I can recall about that was when I was little, he used to have his cavalry boots and his spurs and all that stuff.
Huh.
So,
wow.
But I'm sure that he maybe that's after he he got out of college and joined the military. He either joined up for the cavalry or he was in it, and then obviously things changed and the cavalry became no more. Well, actually, it became the armor division instead of cavalry, and he elected to become a pilot.
Yeah. Where was he born? Where was he from?
He was born, to the best of my knowledge, in Baltimore, Maryland.
Okay. So, I think of Horace, who spent a lot of his time in D.C., and so if he was a nephew, was Albert, was your father's parents, were they from that area?
Yes, they were.
Okay.
And that went back several generations.
Okay.
There were, some were doctors, some were businessmen. They were, my great-great-great-great-grandfather was in the fertilizer business.
Okay.
As was I think he was a chemical engineer. My grandfather was a chemical engineer. I don't know what degree my dad had, if he even had one, I don't know.
Okay.
Could have been the World War II interrupted his college education.
So your dad at Grand Canyon, do you think he got a job there with the help of his uncle?
I sure do.
Okay.
Yes, I do. I'm sure that's how he knew about it.
But it's interesting because, you know, at that time there were a number of parks. It was new. I mean, the Park Service was new, but there was Yosemite and there was Yellowstone and, you know, some other here and there. I wonder what attracted your dad to the Grand Canyon.
That I do not know.
Okay.
And I never had the opportunity to ask him.
Okay.
Or the curiosity to ask him. I guess that would be a better way to put it. I was just not that curious.
Did your dad have any experience flying before the war?
I do not know that either, Tom.
Okay. All right. So he.
I do know he had to. He had to kind of fudge his way through the eye exam.
Uh-huh.
He showed me how to do it when I was trying to pass my driver's license.
What did he tell you?
Well, he and I are both nearsighted.
Okay.
And so what he did, he says, look, you can change the focal length on the back of your retina if you just kind of push up with your finger on your eyelid, on the outside corner of your eyelid, and it changes the focal point.
Ah.
And all of a sudden it changes your nearsightedness into 20/20 vision.
Wow, that's handy to know.
If I did it on my last driver's license about 6 months ago. So
okie doke. How about that?
I can vest to that, and I almost did the same thing when I was in the Army. When there was a levy out for, I was in the Intelligence Corps, and there was a levy out for pilots to run intelligence missions over in Vietnam. And I said, well, why not? Let's try it, because I always wanted to fly. And I cheated my way all the way through the pilot's physical, except depth perception, and I could not do that.
Huh.
So the doctor who was examining me says, for the flight physical, said, how in the world did you get all this other stuff and you'd have no depth perception? I said, well, I cheated. So I went back to Fort Oliver and became a case officer for people.
Okay. Thinking about your mom and dad, so just making sure I understand this, they would have been romancing and aware of each other before the war.
Right.
And they clearly liked each other enough so that when your dad ended up being sent overseas, he stopped and visited with your mom. Did they get married then, or when did they get married?
I think they got married then or shortly thereafter. I think he may have gone to California.
Okay.
and met my mother there. She could have been in college then at San Diego State College.
Okay. All right.
And it could have, I'm sure my sister Ronnie could probably amplify on that. But that's my understanding, is they got married before he went overseas.
Okay. Did your dad ever talk about, you know, flying the what was it, the Burma-China bump there over the Himalayas?
No, he was headed that way. He had flown the Aleutian Islands when the Japanese had landed there on one of that island chain off of Alaska, and he said that was probably the worst weather in the world to fly in. But he flew that, and then he had come back to MacDill Field in Tampa, Florida, to put together a new group, a new bomber group, to head over to China to fly the hump. And he, they were doing training missions and whatnot in that area, because there's two or three different airfields in addition to MacDill Field there in Tampa. And he got up about 500 feet one day with his crew, and all of a sudden something went haywire and he came down.
Ooh.
He was able to save the crew, and nobody died or anything like that. And as a matter of fact, he wound up the worst for wear of everybody, because I can remember when I was about 1 year old, maybe one and a half, 2 years old. It had to have been two, because you can't walk too much before that time. But I can remember my mother taking me in the hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, where he was, and walking up the stairs and the color of the stairs and everything and the wall, and seeing my dad in a bed with, I mean, he was from head to toe in totally wrapped up like a mummy.
Okay, like in a cast, in a full body cast?
No, it was full body cast.
Wow.
And that's one enduring memory I have of him. And that would have been in, I guess, sometime between 1944 and 1945.
Okay.
If I was born in 1943.
Okay. Yeah, there were a lot of servicemen that did not make it through air training.
Well, apparently what happened was they found out later that there was some sabotage.
Oh, wow.
And some group had sabotaged a lot of the airplanes down there at MacDill Field.
Wow.
Because his was not the only one. But he was, you know, everybody survived, but apparently he got the brunt of it. So.
So he must have been released from the service then in 45?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he was.
And where did your folks decide to go?
Well, my grandfather was a chemical engineer. He graduated from Swarthmore College back in the 1920s.
This was your dad's dad?
Yes, my dad's dad.
What was his name?
Albert B. Baker Sr., or the only Albert.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Time. And in fact, my dad got named after him because he and a friend of his at college had a bet as who was going to have the first son.
Uh-huh.
And if they had the first son, they're going to have to name that person after the other person. So that's how he got to be Junior. That's how I got to be number three.
Okay. All right.
But my grandfather, my great-grandfather, like I say, was in the fertilizer business and apparently a well-respected businessman in the city of Baltimore.
Okay.
And had farms and all kinds of stuff there. My grandfather went to Swarthmore College, where he was all-star athlete in basketball, baseball, and lacrosse was a big game then.
Mm-hmm.
My great-grandfather started the one of the famous lacrosse clubs, Mount Washington Lacrosse Club, named after the community that he had our farm in.
Okay.
But my grandfather played professional baseball for the Washington Senators.
Okay.
After he graduated from college, and then, as I say, he got his degree in chemical engineering. And I guess World War One came up prior to his business career. So he went into the chemical corps as a captain in the chemical corps.
This is like mustard gas kind of chemical corps?
Yeah, same stuff.
Okay. How did he survive that?
Well, he did.
Good for him.
I don't know whether he went to Europe or not, to be honest with you.
Okay.
But I do know after that, he got a job as a consultant. He was went to work for a consultancy, and I don't know who they are. But he went to Freeport, Texas, on a job there, and for Texas Gulf Sulfur. And the people at Texas Gulf liked him so much in the job that he did that they gave him a bunch of stock in the company. And the company my granddad worked for said, "Oh, we can't accept that, and you can't accept that. You have to give it back." So my grandfather said, "Well, to hell with you. I'm going to go start my own company where I can do whatever I want."
Oh, wow.
And he did, and that was the derivation of Bradley and Baker. And so, long story short, that's who my dad worked for after he got out of, well, actually, before he went into the Army, he worked for Bradley and Baker, and then worked for them afterwards, after he got out of the hospital.
Okay, and what did they do, Bradley and Baker?
We were fertilizer
people. Okay.
We built fertilizer, and we sold fertilizer all over the world.
Okay.
And we were in the UNESCO program for the United Nations,
okay,
where we sold fertilizer. We had a company called Bradley and Baker, and then not Columbia Nitrogen. It was Bradley and Baker, and we did a deal back in the 1950s with the Dutch fertilizer cartel, who were the big fertilizer people in the rest of the world, and we worked with them throughout the entire world.
Okay.
Selling, you know, much like Exxon and Royal Dutch Shell and people like that sold their hydrocarbon products throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
Bradley and Baker and I cannot pronounce the Dutch fertilizer cartel's name. The initials are USV.
Okay.
But if you know anything about Dutch, they're long, long words with not a whole lot of vowels in them.
Okay.
And they made a deal on how to market the products, and they put together fertilizer plants. We had some all along the East Coast and around to the Gulf Coast, from New York City all around to Houston, Texas, as far as shipping ports, the major ship ports. And then we had fertilizer plants in Florida, where we manufactured both nitrogen-based fertilizers and also limestone-based fertilizers.
Oh, wow.
And we sold them all over the world for this cartel. But our main interest was North America, South America, the Caribbean, and that's where we spent most of our time. And then there were other people working with the cartel who took care of the rest of the world.
Okay.
So when my grandfather was president, my dad, paternalistically, I'm sure, was vice president.
Okay.
And he handled all the marketing.
So, I'm trying to think of, how's that, because I thought you were raised at Grand Canyon.
Well, I spent a whole lot of time in Grand Canyon. I mean, from when I was 6 years old, My mother took me out there to stay with my grandparents, and she stayed there.
Got it.
And
okay.
Then we would go back and forth and back and forth. My sister Ronnie and I, one fall, when my parents had to go overseas on a business trip and be gone for an extended period of time, Ronnie and I lived with my grandparents. And
okay, so hang on a second. Let's back up sort of I'm thinking here. So you're in Hartford, Connecticut, when you're born in 43. And so your first time to Grand Canyon, would that have been when you were six, or did you come out there?
When I was about 6 months later.
Okay.
Because when I was 6 months older, because my dad was off at war, and my mother picked me up and got on the train and took me out to her parents' house.
Okay.
So I've got a picture of me barely able to walk. And, you know, behind the El Tovar Hotel, you have the walkway and the wall and all that stuff.
Yep.
Overlooking the canyon.
Yep.
And there's a picture of me reaching up and grabbing the top of that stone wall.
Huh.
And walking around. So
fun.
That was the earliest that I know of that I was there. And I stayed there until after Dad got out of the hospital. Or Dad, you know, got off of the hospital there in Tampa, Florida, and got sent to the hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. And then I think that's when we moved to that part of the country.
Okay. So it sounds like between the ages of 6 months and 6 years old, would your folks like vacation their summers with your mom's parents then at the South Rim?
Not necessarily. I'm not sure I would call it vacations, but you know, we'd get on the train and go back and forth. I can recall that. But my main memory was when I was in the third grade. Now, however old you'd be in the third grade, I don't recall. But that's when my sister and I went to school out there with the Indians and the Verkamp kids and everybody.
All right, so you might have been 10. Let's see, third grade, 10, I'm 12, 13. Yeah, right around in there. I was thinking if you'd went to first grade, you were 6 or 7.
Well, she was in the first grade, and I was in the third grade.
Okay, so the
fall that we spent out there. But I don't know how old you would be at that time. Would you be 7 or 8? Or
right.
I mean, that's
okay.
What I don't know.
Okay.
But I do remember it was a one-room schoolhouse.
Okay.
At least for us it was one room, because you had grades 1 through 6 in the one room.
Okay, so
now,
hang on a second. Wait, Tersh. I'm sorry, hang on a second. I'm just trying to work out this timeline here. Because you guys were living back east with the fertilizer company going, sounds like great guns.
Right.
How was it that you ended up going to school at the South Rim in third grade instead of back east?
Oh, because my parents had to go over to Europe to do some business.
Oh.
And they were going to be there for quite some time.
Okay.
You know, a couple, 3 months.
For the fertilizer business.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So they took us out there on the Santa Fe and put us down with my grandmother and grandfather there and said, we'll see y'all in a while.
Oh my gosh. What do you remember about that train trip?
The train trip was not all that exciting. What I remember is all the stuff that I did when I got there.
Like what?
Train trip is you would go to, you take a train and you go to Chicago to pick up the Santa Fe, because the Santa Fe only ran from, as I recall, from Chicago to Los Angeles.
Right. This is the Santa Fe
and
Chief.
And yeah, Santa Fe Chief and the Super Chief.
Okay.
And you get on that, and about 2.5 days later, I think we got to Flagstaff, where you are.
Okay.
And then my grandfather would meet the train there at Flagstaff and drive us back up to the canyon.
Oh, wow. So he wouldn't. So you guys wouldn't go to Williams and take the train up that way. He would actually pick you up in the car.
No, he'd pick us up. I guess it could have been Williams, wherever. You know, there was a spur off of Santa Fe from Williams up to the South Rim.
Right.
And no, we never took the train from Williams up north.
Okay.
He just come meet us there at the station.
Oh, okay.
Gather us up and
yep.
take us on. And I guess I'm sorry, it probably was Williams rather than Flagstaff.
Yeah, that would make sense. Do you remember that drive from Williams up to the canyon?
Oh yeah, every one. I sure do.
What was the road like? What was your earliest recollections of the road?
Well, it was two lane, and
paved with.
It was a paved. It was an improved road.
Okay.
It was not like going out into Indian country,
right?
Which was, you know, senderos and dry washes,
right?
Back in those days,
right?
Because I remember my father and grandfather used to have an argument about how fast to go, and my grandfather said, "Well, if you take my car, you better go 30." And my father says, "Well, I want to go faster than that," so you know. Anyway, I recall that as being a conversation back in the day.
Do you think your grandfather knew how to hook horses to a wagon?
You know, that's an interesting question, Tom, and I'm not sure he was. I mean, he would have been old enough because, like I say, he showed up at the canyon around 1919, 1920.
Right.
And so certainly that was the main mode of transportation in those days, particularly out in that part of the world. So, I mean, I'd have to say, yeah, I'm sure he did.
Do you think your dad knew how to do that?
Probably not. He could throw a saddle and, you know, get on and get after it. But,
right.
I don't think he had that much experience.
Well, it's just interesting because I think your grandfather would have looked at 30 miles an hour a lot different than your dad looked at 30 miles an hour.
Probably so. Yeah, particularly if you were in a buggy or, you know, a washboard wagon or something like that.
Right.
And you had to drive, you know, in those arroyos and dry washes. Yeah. Because when I was a little kid, I used to ride with him. Since what he became the JP, the Justice of the Peace,
okay,
of that part of Coconino County, which meant, you know, he by law had to go down. Remember back in the 50s, they had a couple really horrific airplane crashes in the canyon. And he used to have to go down there and certify, you know, the dead, et cetera, et cetera. So
you would have been 13 in 1956 when the TWA and United planes crashed here just 7 days from now, June 30th.
Really?
Yeah, 1956.
Yeah, no, he was down there. He flew down there in a helicopter, and he had to do the certification process.
Okay. Did he ever talk about that?
Not in great detail, and I didn't ask in great detail.
Okay.
I didn't ask all the gory details and
yeah.
everything like that, but he would mention to me, you know, in passing, that, yeah, that's one of the things I had to do and whatnot. He was kind of the law in that part of the country. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but he kind of ran, when I was little, he ran the south rim of the canyon.
Okay.
And down to running the Saturday night movies at the, I forgot what they had. They had a kind of a town hall.
Yeah, the community building?
Yeah, community building.
Okay.
And every Saturday night in the summer, every Saturday night in the summer, we had a full feature movie.
Okay.
And he ran the projector. And so, you know, it was just like being in a movie theater. You had the cartoons, you had the newsreels, and then you had your feature film.
Okay.
And that's what he did. He pretty much took care of everything else in that community because they, A, had been there so long, and then B, because he was the judge.
Right. At
and that's what they called him, was Judge Stevens.
Okay. All right. You mentioned he was sort of a circuit judge, if you will, for Coconino County.
Right.
And I'm thinking, would that have gotten him, let's see, Kingman is in Mojave County. Page would have been coming online in 57, 58, 59 for Glen Canyon Dam. Fredonia was right on the border there of Mojave, I think.
That was would have been down south.
Right. I'm thinking of Fredonia's right up on the Arizona Strip, just south of Kanab. And then Sedona might have been in his turf, and Flagstaff, of course, but there would have been other judges in Flagstaff.
Sure.
I'm just trying to think of what territory he would have driven around.
Well, it was all Indian country.
Okay.
But, and it was, you know, Hopi reservations 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
And a lot of, you know, out of Cameron.
Yep.
The trading post there at Cameron.
Okay.
And then it would have been the Navi country north of Cameron.
Okay.
That did not get over.
Tuba City.
East a little bit.
Kayenta, Chinle. But now we got to be careful because we go too far. We get into Apache County and Navajo County.
No, that's way too far to the east.
Right, too far east.
Apache County.
Okay.
No, it's basically his area was the south rim of the canyon.
Okay.
And down into some of the Verkamp acreage south of the canyon.
Okay.
They're pretty good ranchers down there.
Okay.
And then it was east of the county to Cameron, across the river, and then 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Mesa on the Hopi side, and then I don't know how far west he went, but he certainly got into some of the Navi country too.
Okay.
Now, he did not have the north rim of the canyon.
Okay. Huh.
That was at least not to my knowledge.
Okay.
I don't know. I know he went over there a lot.
Did you get
I went over there with him.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you get to ride with him on his circuit?
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine it might have been neat, but it might have been boring, too, if he's holding court.
Nah, he was never a boring guy. Let me tell you that.
Tell me more about him.
No, well, he had a great personality, and that probably enabled him to become the position that he was. I assume it was an elected position, like what we have here in Texas.
Okay.
But he was just a really good guy. And he would do things like, you know, back in the day when the train would move some of the selected Santa Fe cars from Williams up to the canyon to the South Rim, you know, it always was a steam engine that brought them up there, at least in the 50s it was. And so he would arrange for me to get in the engine cab with the engineer.
Oh, wow.
And the engineer would take me, I don't know, 5-10 miles down the track from the station there at South Rim.
Mm-hmm.
There was a road that crossed, and they would stop there, and the train would stop there, the engineer would let me off. My grandfather was there to pick me up, take me back to the house for the night for supper.
Huh.
So, I mean, we did all kinds of things like
that's
that.
That's neat. Was that maybe Anita where they stopped?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, like I say, I was in my, you know, third grade. I was probably, you know, 10 years old or whatever it was.
Huh. That's great.
But he would do things like that, and we would go out, and you know, he was buds with all the ranchers in the area and whatnot. We go out there and hit their country and drive through the summer thunderstorms, which was kind of exciting because, you know, the lightning that comes along with it.
Yeah.
And we were riding around in a tin roof Jeep. And it got pretty loud. So
I bet it did.
A lot of times we turned around, but we were just an all-around good guy.
Did he have any legal training?
I don't know, Tom.
Okay.
In Texas, you do not need legal training to be a JP.
Okay.
It's an elected position here to represent the county or a district or something like that.
Okay.
I mean, you have the legal ability and the purview to settle disputes and this, that, and the other kind of thing. And I don't know whether you can send people to jail or not. I don't know.
I would imagine you could. You could find people.
Like a district judge.
What do you remember about Cameron, your earliest memories of Cameron?
I remember the old bridge.
Yep. Could you walk on it? Was it a walking bridge then?
Hell no, we drove over it.
Okay, so the highway bridge hadn't been built yet, the concrete pylons thing.
No. Because, I mean, the last time I was in that part of the world, I remember there was a brand new road.
Yeah.
You know, going across it that looked pretty stable.
Yep.
And the old bridge, because my daughter and I went now, because she didn't go with me at that, was still there.
Okay.
But it was closed off.
Right.
You couldn't use it.
Be a nice walking bridge.
That was one of the trading posts that we would go to. And I remember every time we went through there, I wanted to buy a Kachina.
Oh, wow. Doll.
And so I still have a couple left over.
Nice.
From way back in the 50s.
Nice.
My grandfather was friends with some of the big-time artisans.
Okay.
And I can't call their names right now, but I still got some of their paintings.
I'm thinking of the Cabotes.
The Cabotes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he was big buds with the Cabotes, and we would go out there. Obviously, it was in the summer. Usually, it was in August.
Okay.
The semi-rain season.
Yep.
That you have there. And, of course, for some reason, that's when the Hopis had their rain dances.
Right.
So we'd go out to Mesa 1 or Mesa 2 and sit on top of one of the Pueblo houses and watch the rain dances.
Nice.
And then we used to have to hurry like hell to get back because those dry washes turned into running streams and rivers if you waited too long.
Yeah.
So, we would do that when we were kids, and that was a lot of fun. And Ronnie and I would run. I mean, we'd be arrested for what we did since the whole state is a national park now.
Right.
But, I mean, they'd let us loose, and we'd run all over the painted desert.
Nice.
And we get up on the sand dunes and slide down. And, you know, if we saw a piece of rock.
Petrified wood
that would catch our fancy, we'd grab it and take it home.
Nice. Yep. Back in the day.
Now, the last time I was out there, you can't spit on the sidewalk without getting arrested.
It's a different day with a lot more people running around, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, that's my... And the last time I was there, I stopped in Cameron and bought a couple nice blankets. I don't know how many more. One thing I would like to do, and one thing my mother kindly did for me, is give me a subscription to Arizona Highways.
Oh, uh-huh, yep.
And one of the last magazines I got from them is they mentioned where the last remaining trading posts were.
Oh, nice, huh?
On the north side
of
the canyon.
Okay.
A couple of Navy trading posts up there and whatnot. I'd love to go out and see them. I could never find one except for Cameron, but I was going kind of northeast.
Okay.
And not northwest towards the north rim and then out further, in the gap up there.
Right, right. That's right. You mentioned you went to third grade, and let's see, look at the time here. Yeah, let's open that up a little bit. So this would have been in the fall semester or in the spring semester?
Fall semester, in the early 50s.
What do you remember about that? You mentioned that that was a one-room schoolhouse?
Well, it was a new, it was the new schoolhouse. It's not the the wooden one that they have preserved.
Okay.
You know, on the south rim.
Yep.
It was a new schoolhouse, and it was, you know.
So this is the cement. Rock, yeah, cement and rock kind of stone on the outside?
I think so. All I really remember was the inside.
Okay.
And the long hallway, and we were on, like I say, grades 1 through 6. We're on the left-hand side of the hallway.
Okay.
And I don't remember whether there were any others.
Would have been 7 and 8, I think.
I wondered about 7 and 8, but I never saw them.
Right. So that would have been on the right, I bet, on the other side of the hall. I wonder. Huh.
I don't know, but I wondered about that too. But, you know, at that time, they're trying to teach me mathematics and multiplication tables.
Right.
I didn't pay much attention to it anyway.
Okay.
But what I do remember, and there was one teacher, and that teacher taught all 6 grades.
Wow. Okay.
So your first 40 minutes was first grade, and then she'd move up to second grade, and then she'd hit third grade, and then she'd hit fourth, fifth, and sixth. And that was the day. And in the interim time, when she wasn't teaching your particular grade, you know, you're supposed to do your homework and blah, blah, blah. And probably the most interesting thing that I remember of that year was that the University of Southern California was coming to Arizona to play the play against the U of A that fall.
Okay.
And whoever the coach was at Southern Cal decided to give his boys a treat and get off the train at Williams and take the little train up to South Rim.
Okay.
So all of a sudden we were sitting in class one day, and the principal or whoever ran the school said, "All right, class is out. You know, we're going to go to the field." And we had there was a general all-purpose dirt field.
Okay.
Had some bleachers, and Grand Canyon had a baseball team.
Okay.
And I don't remember who they played, but, you know, they would play Saturday games. And it wasn't semi-pro or anything like that, but they were in some kind of league or something. Maybe it was within the park service or something. I don't know. But anyway, there was a regulation size dirt baseball field and an outfield. I don't really recall how much there was, but that's where Southern Cal practiced.
Oh, wow.
That afternoon.
Okay.
And they were all togged out in their crimson and gold and everything like that.
Hmm.
And as it turned out, number 16, Frank Gifford, was there that day. And he, you know, a guy that went on to play, he was for the New York Giants.
Okay.
Pro, and I think he was an All-American that year, too, for Southern California.
Okay.
And I remember watching him intently.
Huh.
And he didn't give a flip whether it was there or not. Matter of fact, what he would do would pick up rocks and throw them at an empty 55-gallon oil can.
Wow.
And that's it. But he was my hero for a while.
Okay.
Because I just sat and, you know, as a third grader, just watched him.
Hmm.
But that was the highlight of my scholastic career.
Okay.
At the Grand Canyon, I guess, junior high school, because they didn't have a high school there.
Right. Right. Okay, so you got to see Frank come in and play a little bit.
No, he didn't do anything. He just kind of stood around, kicked dirt, and threw rocks at the can when, you know, guys were going through calisthenics and doing this.
Right, he was working on his aim.
Yeah, I guess he was.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
He got to throw the ball because he was tailback, and he certainly did with the Giants as well in professional leagues. But I do remember my grandfather would tell me, let's go to the baseball game. They had Saturday baseball games.
Okay.
And I do not know who they were playing.
Huh.
But I would sit there in a little rickety stand and, you know, watch them play baseball.
Okay.
The other thing my granddad and I would do is we would go down to Flagstaff around the 4th of July, if I'm not mistaken, and we would go to the All Indian Rodeo.
Tell me about that.
Do they still do that?
No.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah, no, it was a big deal in Flag for a long time.
Oh, it was a huge deal. And it was all Indians. And you had the Navvies and you had the little fat Hopis. You know, everybody doing their thing. They had some Apaches there. But the interesting thing, and I didn't realize it at the time until my granddad told me, is you also had some, kind of at the end of it, I think it was a three-day deal, and the Anglo ranchers would come on in, and they would put their guys up against the Indians.
Hmm.
So the first couple of days, the Indians would kind of, you know, soften off a little bit, not show everything they had, and they would bet. And there was all manner of bets going on back in the 50s between the Anglo cowboys and the Indians, particularly the Navvies.
Okay.
The Hopis didn't do it, but it was all Navajo. And, you know, they would, who's going to be the bronc rider? Who's going to do this? Who's going to do that?
So they were betting on the rodeo?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were betting on what their guys, their team could do on the rodeo. And they were betting on all the rodeo events.
Huh. Okay.
So if you had a bronc, you know, a Navy bronc rider, and they were tremendous horsemen.
Yes.
You know, they might get off at 8 seconds or something like that, and they might not get off, you know, didn't worry about 10, but by God, when you had the money on the line, it was 10 plus the whole damn time.
Mm.
And so, you know, that my grandfather thought that was pretty funny, and I guess now that I think about it, it was too, but it was really neat to watch that stuff. And that's where I got my appreciation for that part of the country.
Mm. Okay. Do you remember any other sort of festivals of Thanksgiving or Christmas there at the South Rim at all?
No, we were not there for Christmas or Thanksgiving. We were there for Easter.
Okay.
And what I remember is the Easter sunrise services out on the rim.
Okay.
On the South Rim. And I've forgotten where they were held. They were I think there was a cross there, so I assume it's still there, or it would have been, you know, in your time frame there. But I remember how majestic it was.
Mm.
You know, you get out there 5:30, 5:45 in the morning, and that's one thing my mother always insisted that we do. So, you know, you go out there, and it was just absolutely magnificent to watch the sun come out over the canyon.
Yeah.
And be involved in a service.
Nice. Okay. What do we got here? We've been talking about 55 minutes here. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma on this interview and wrap up part one. Before we take on part two down the road a little bit, what do you think?
That's fine.
Okay. I
mean, we can go on. We can just however you have your interview organized.
Yeah, I'm thinking this is probably a good place to start this because I think we're going to open up some more stuff that is going to take a little more time. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the ground we've covered that I didn't ask you?
Oh, I didn't tell you about when we were little kids there living with my grandparents, and I used to have to, remember one afternoon, it was 4th of July, and so my grandmother and grandfather got us some watermelons. And, of course, we had deer in our yard all the time, mule deer.
Okay.
And, I mean, they used to put their heads in the window of the kitchen when my grandmother was cooking breakfast. And I'd go out and shoo them away, and I remember my sister, she's a little bitty thing, in the first grade, and she had a big old slice of watermelon. She was chewing on it. And this one deer came up and tried to get after it, and I pushed that deer away, and that deer kicked the snot out of me.
Wow.
And we would have deer, in the yard all the time. I remember my main job with my grandparents, well, I had two, but the main one was when we got up in the morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, I had to go out and to the coal bin. All those houses there on the south rim, if you drive down the, there's a front road, like we lived on Avenue A.
Okay.
And they call it a patch or something like that. But if you go down to the end of the street and you turn either left or right, whichever way you're going, but there is a back street. And on the back street, there is a little wooden building. And that wooden building was full of coal.
Okay.
And it was full of wood, cut wood.
Oh, interesting.
And so my job when I was 7 or 8 years old was go out with a coal shovel and get into the coal bin and fill that thing up with coal and then come back with a big thing of wood, because my grandmother cooked her absolutely delicious meals on a wooden coal stove.
Okay. And she wasn't alone.
Oh, no. No, no, I'm sure everybody there did.
Right.
But it was absolutely delicious cook, but people in this part of the country at this point in time do not remember cooking on coal and wood stoves.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. Okay, I think what I'd like to do is wrap this up here, and then next time I want to pick this up more about what you remember about living on Avenue A and about the powerhouse and about the bear camps and just get into a little bit more about what you remember about the people that were there.
I'd be happy to.
That would be...
Just tell me when a good time would be.
Okay, that would be good. Well, what let's do is let's go ahead and wrap this up. This will then conclude what is now part one of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Tersh Baker, and that's Albert B. Baker III. Goes by Tersh, T-E-R-S-H. Today is Thursday, June 23rd, 2022. And Tersh, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom. Good to talk with you, sir.